Today I'm going to be talking about information processing approaches to cognitive development. And I'm going to start with a brief introduction, giving it some historical context, and then we'll define two concepts that are really central to not only cognitive development theories in general, but information processing systems as well, or generally. And those concepts are representation and computation. And then finally, I will talk about two different information processing frameworks, theoretical frameworks, the symbolic approach and the connections approach. So the questions that we ask in cognition, cognitive development, are really quite ancient. They go back at least as far as Aristotle. The Greek philosophers were asking questions about consciousness, learning, memory, these sorts of things. And the kinds of questions that they were asking, such as, how does information impinging on the senses get transformed into usable knowledge? Where are memories stored? These sorts of things. These are really computational questions, computational in nature, even though they didn't understand the idea of computation explicitly, nor would we have the details of computing machinery for 2,500 years. And if we go back just a few hundred years to Descartes, he actually worked out, or diagrammed at least, some really detailed information processing models of the sensory motor system. He thought higher cognitive functions were not sort of instantiated in this material world, but as far as sensory motor stuff goes, he drew some pictures, which are quite interesting and very information processing oriented. And then William James, at the turn of the century, worked out a pretty detailed theory based on neuroscience that is quite close to what we know today based on more detailed studies. So these questions have been around for a long time, and they've generally been addressed computationally. If you want a detailed history of this area, you should see Professor Gardner's book, The Mind's New Science. So the first concept that I want to define is representation. And as we've looked at different theories in this class, Piaget and Bruner and Carmeloff-Smith, for example, they all explicitly talk about representation in their theories, as part of their theories. For instance, Piaget's theory of stages, the logics that underlie each stage, Piaget is essentially talking about the representation that the child has at that point in development. Bruner posited the existence of these three qualitatively different kinds of representations during development, the enactive, iconic, and symbolic. And Carmeloff-Smith, of course, at the center of her theory is what she calls representational redescription, which is how representations get reformatted during development, or micro-development within the domain. To give the intuition about what representation is, it's Jean Mandler, you can see her chapter in the handbook, volume 2, on representation. She says it's anything that changes future behavior. So to give kind of a concrete example from the animal world, if we take a rat and put it into a maze, an unfamiliar maze that it's not seen before, which has two branches, initially the rat will have no representation, no knowledge about the space that it's in. If it explores the space and finds food down the left quarter and a cat down the right, it'll very quickly learn to always go down the left quarter when placed back at the starting position. That's because it has learned something about this environment and now has a representation of this area. And more generally, we can think of representation as synonymous with knowledge, except that when we talk about representations, we're putting an emphasis on the format in which that knowledge is stored in the brain or elsewhere. So to give a concrete example from the human domain, from the human world, we think about the alphabet, the English alphabet. We can write the letters, we can speak the letters. Those are two different formats for the same knowledge, the same letters, right? But more sort of widely, we can think about how a computer would represent the letters, and that's called the ASCII code, American Standard Code for Information Interchange, and we assign a number to each different letter. And then another representational format for the same knowledge, again, is Morse code, where we use a series of dashes and dots to represent all of the letters in the alphabet. The second concept that is central to these issues is computation. And we have some usual associations with the word computation. We might think of it as the objects that compute, such as digital computers, or we might think of it in terms of mathematical savants, people who can do all kinds of amazing numerical operations in their head. But computation is actually a much more broad and abstract idea or concept than just these particular instantiations of it that we're familiar with. And it's hard to define computation precisely because it's used differently in different domains and by different people with different ends. So this more abstract idea of computation applies equally well to things like biological evolution, where you can think of evolution as a giant sort of search process, where this evolutionary process is searching for genomes for individuals that are more fit. You can think of it in terms of language, where there's a transformation from some deep conceptual structure in my head, which is may or may not be linguistic, which then gets transformed into utterances or notational writings. That's computational as well. Or a third example is a tinker toy machine that plays tic-tac-toe. It doesn't have any gears or any computer components, but you enter your move X or O in the right spot, and it will respond, and it can play a perfect game of tic-tac-toe, which is to say that it'll never lose. That also is a kind of computation, very different from what we normally think of. So in terms of what we're talking about in this class, we can think of computation as a transformation from one representation to another. But note that this idea of representation is central to this idea of computation in the sense that not all transformations are computational. For example, if you think of a tornado, that's a kind of process that transforms buildings into rubble, but since the buildings and the rubble don't represent anything meaningful, that's not a computational system. It's very important when thinking about information processing models of cognitive development, it's very important not to confuse the computer on which the theory runs with the computational content of the theory itself. People often make the misattribution that information processing theories of mind or brain can't possibly be right because computers don't have any of the sort of behavioral qualities or they don't look or act anything like a child. They don't have the same influences. But in the same way, to take an analogy, meteorologists take data from weather satellites and build models of weather patterns and try and predict in the future, but nobody would claim that as a bad model because, you know, a computer is not like the storm that they're modeling, or, you know, the computer doesn't contain a storm. I think the confusion comes in because the things we're trying to model, which is children's cognitive abilities, share some enough properties that people think that a deeper claim is being made about the computer than it is. So these two ideas, representation and computation, although they're distinct, they have some very important relationship to one another. The first is that not all representations lend themselves equally well to all sets of computations. To give you an example, if you think about our decimal number system, the familiar number system, we can represent, say, the number 27 as a 2 and a 7. And in binary, the number 27 would be a series of 1s and 0s appropriately arranged. And then we have many other bases that we use, for instance, in computers science, base 8, base 16, and we can represent numbers equally well there. So if we want primarily to be multiplying numbers by 10, or powers of 10, 10, 100, 1,000, then we should use the decimal representation for our number system, because you can simply add as many zeros as you need to turn 27 into 270, simply add a zero, that's multiplying by 10. Multiplication by 10 is much harder in a binary representation, which is base 2. And then if you think about the Roman numeral system, which is another perfectly good representation, it's not very good if you want to do multiplication as your operation, because there's no general algorithm. The representation is very, very bad for doing multiplication. And the second point with respect to the interrelationship between these two things, these two concepts, is that you need to represent, there's this idea of sort of representational capacity or power. And you need to have a representation which can distinguish all of the important elements in whatever system you're representing. So for instance, if I wanted to make a Morse code, but I wanted to use a dash and a dot, and I could only have a sequence of two dashes or dots, I could have the following distinct elements in my representation. Dash, 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 dot, dot, dash, and dot, dot. Now I could represent A, B, C, and D, perhaps, but this representation is underpowered to get all 26 letters of the alphabet. So this idea becomes important. And computations can transform among representations, right, that's how we're thinking of that. They can transform between representations of different representational power. So just take an example of addition. If I add the numbers 2 and 5, I get 7, and if I throw away the original operands, I have no way of knowing whether it came from a 3 plus 4 or a 5 plus 2 or a 6 plus 1 or whatever. So that is, got, in a sense, less representational power. David Marr was an important researcher on vision, and he wrote a very influential book among people who study information processing approaches called Vision. And in that book, he suggested that to understand any information processing system, whether it's animal world, human cognition, a computer system, you need to understand it at three distinct levels of analysis. The first level of analysis, you need to understand it as far as what is the goal of the system, what is the system trying to do or compute. So I'll use his example of vision. The visual system for humans is, the goal of it is to find out what objects are in the environment around me and where they are in relation to one another and what their properties are. And so that's the high level sort of goal of the computation is to do that. At the next level down, we've got representation and algorithm, and we've already talked a bit about representation and computation, which are kind of map onto those. The idea is you need to be specific about what information is coming into the system and what operations are being performed on it. You need to be specific, but you can characterize them abstractly because we don't yet aren't talking about the implementation level. So, for instance, in the case of a visual system, information is coming in from the two eyes, and I get parallax information, which tells me depth information. I can see different patterns of light and darkness, which give me sort of contour information. That's some of the information that's in the system, or the representation. And then the algorithms are things like edge finding. I use the contrast information and run some operation on it to pick the edges of one object from another and distinguish those. But still, we haven't made any strong commitments to how this thing would run either on a computer or in a human nervous system or anywhere else. That is the third level at which we need to understand these systems, which is implementation. And that's when you need to translate your abstract representation and algorithms into the particular material substrate on which you want to either simulate or carry out this computational operation. Now, I've loosely put some of the theorists that we've been looking at on this picture. This should not be taken as sort of hard and fast. The point is that we can think about where people's grounding was, people being these cognitive developmental researchers. For instance, Piaget was trying, he talked about assimilation, accommodation, equilibration, schemas, operations, and he wasn't very specific about what information is in the system. So at that level, he's talking about the goal of the computation to equilibrate, for instance. Although as he talks about the structures which underlie, the logical structures that underlie each stage, we can sort of see him moving down more toward a representational level of analysis because he was quite specific about that, at least abstractly. He didn't say how the brain develops those, but he did say exactly what they entailed. At the next level of analysis, we can think about the symbol processing people, which I'll be talking about in just a bit, people like Newell and Simon who pioneered that approach. And they talked about symbolic structures, sort of macro structures and algorithms on them, but they were agnostic as far as if I run this theory, which is a program on a computer, and I can observe its behavior, they wanted to make the strong claim that I don't then need to understand how to instantiate it in a brain because I'm describing it at this other level of analysis. As long as the inputs and outputs match, we can say that they're in a sense equivalent, in an important sense. And then the third level of analysis, the implementation, the connectionists, who I'll also be talking about, neuroscientists, they try to understand how do the large-scale computations, the psychological constructs and stuff, how are they, we begin with a description of the neuroanatomy, the neurodynamics, and trying to understand how these larger-scale problem-solving consciousness models arise out of it. And Marr's point that you need to understand the system at all three levels is well taken, and you might think that it's sort of trivial to define the goal of the system, but it's in fact not. And so I'll give you an example. When researchers were studying the visual system of the horseshoe crab, they were able to determine exactly how many neurons there were, how they were arranged and connected to one another, what the synaptic dynamics were like, and yet they had no idea what the visual system was for, because this crab does not use it for hunting prey or avoiding predators, so they had to do some behavioral kinds of experiments before they would understand that it uses solely to identify a mate. And if an object of a certain size moves at a certain rate in front of the crab, it will identify, the visual system kicks in and identifies that as a mate. And so it's important to try and, I think, it's important for researchers, or they think it's important, to try and collect information from these three levels of analysis in order to make them consistent before we can make claims that we fully understand an information processing system such as the brain, the developing brain. So the first approach that I want to talk about is, I'm not going to spend much time on because it's quite intuitive. It's called the symbolic approach. And as I said, it was pioneered by Simon and Newell around the 50s and 60s. And more contemporary, more recently, people like Fiegler and Klar have added developmental aspects to it to try and capture what happens through cognitive development in the early years. And the intuitive idea is this. You can take an expert in, let's say, chess or any other domain, and you can ask them, what are the rules by which you play well, you play chess well, and what's the information, what are the things that you attend to in the game, you know, the pieces, the different ways they can move, my queen is exposed, so I should, do some move to protect her, it. So the information in the system for them, the representations, are symbolic, symbol structures and rules on symbols. Sentences, propositions. I just gave you an example of a rule. If my king is undefended, let's say I should castle. That would be the kind of rule that would be in a symbolic theory, of which we didn't want this program. The processes are things like production systems, those if-then rules, and grammars is another example from sort of Chomsky linguistics. If you can create a grammar and say any sentence which I can get through and parse using this grammar is grammatical, otherwise it's not, that's another kind of rule that the symbolic approach would use. And then the developmental perspective, Newell and Simon did not talk about it so much, but later researchers have, and the way they add developmental aspects to this is they add with a set of kind of meta rules which change the actual rules. So, for instance, if a kid is doing a balance beam task at an early age and attends only to the weight and not the distance from the peg, that might be sort of one of the rules. If the weight is greater on one side, then that side should go down. Make a prediction that side should go down. And then there would be these meta rules that say, okay, at the second stage of development, insert a new rule that says, if the weights are equal, then pay attention to distance. And so that's how developmental trajectories are. They attempted to model those. So a concrete example of this is a symbolic model of how we learn to read aloud. And this model makes a couple of assumptions. First, people can pronounce novel letter strings like flint or mave. And this leads to the assumption of this model that people have these sort of general rules based on experience with words in the world that they can use to pronounce regular words, words that have a regular mapping from the visual representation to the spelling. So flint and mave get pronounced that way. The second assumption is that people can pronounce words that break the general rules, like pint or half. They don't fit the same rule as flint or mave. And so this leads to the assumption in the model that there is sort of a second structure in the brain, or a second set of processes that deal with these exceptions. So in the diagram, we have visual input coming in at the top, and then the way to kind of think about it is it flows through and it makes a determination, is this an exception that I know? And if it is, I will just sort of, so if the word is pint, then pronounce it according to the following rules. If it's not in the exception store, the lexicon store, then it sort of drops down to the next level. They see it as kind of two roots, but there's some kind of way to arbitrate between which one will be fired. Then use the general rule for words that I know that are structured the same way. And so you can see that slint or nave would not be recognized, and so they would drop down and be pronounced in the regular way, whereas pint and have would be captured by the exception branch of the loop. Now, the support for this is, some of the support for this model comes from two kinds of dyslexia. There are more than two, but two in particular that they looked at. One being phonological dyslexia, where people can read actual words without difficulty, but they cannot pronounce non-words. So the thinking here is that they have sort of this lexical store, they're familiar with all the words that they've encountered, and so if they encounter those again, they can pronounce them. But they don't have these general rules. This whole branch of the system is broken. Whereas surface dyslexics have exactly the opposite problem. They can pronounce regular words and non-words, but they tend to regularize the exceptions. And so the thinking is that this other branch is sort of broken in their cognitive system. So they've got the general rules, and they can apply it to words, non-words, and exceptions, but they would then pronounce pint and have, for instance, instead of pint and have, because they have no exceptional information. The symbolic approach has had some pretty dramatic successes and demonstrations. And in particular, it's strengths are in domains which are easily characterized as symbolic, where there's explicit knowledge, such as chess or mathematics or language. They're good at deductive reasoning. If I can give the system a set of facts, such as Socrates is a man, all men are mortal, and it can deduce from that, given a few logical operators, that Socrates must be mortal. Furthermore, it's easy to add facts to the system, right? Because we have them in propositional form, which is very familiar to us. So if I also know that Aristotle is a man, I can immediately deduce that Aristotle must be mortal from the existing things that are there, plus the new fact. So these are some of the strengths, and it also corresponds with their intuition. People like these models because it's sort of the behavior of the models matches well with how we think. The weaknesses, on the other hand, we put these propositional facts in the system, but there's no account of how they get into the system in, say, a human being. I mean, we don't get all of our knowledge through speaking to one another. Sometimes we can. I can tell you the rules for a card game, for instance, and you can immediately play the game flawlessly and even remember that. So that's kind of a one trial learning which the symbolic models are good at. But there's no account of how they actually get into the human system, especially since there's no language to begin with. They're not good at generalizing. If I teach the symbolic model, or I give it the facts that these 10 exemplars of handwritten A's from different people are A's, if I get a new one, it won't be able to handle it. There are tricks you can do and hacks you can add to the system to make it handle that better, but it's still brittle and it's sort of not a natural extension of the model. They're not good at implicit kinds of knowledge, inactive representations, sensory motor kinds of knowledge, things that are not easily put into symbolic form, they have a hard time dealing with. And it's got a whole bunch of if you want to talk about the implementation level, which Mark suggested was important, it's got the wrong qualitative properties from the standpoint of trying to understand the human cognitive system. For instance, if I put in a noisy input, if I say Aristotle and I spell it without an E, is a man, and I want to ask later, is Aristotle mortal, it won't match the fact that I have in my head exactly because I misspelled the name, and this system has a really hard time dealing with that kind of noise. If I break the rules or sort of, you know, damage part of the memory, the whole thing shows catastrophic failure. It goes haywire and anything can happen. Humans, we can have lesions. I mean, there's a kid who's had half his brain removed when he was 3, and he's almost 100% normal as far as skills in all these domains. I mean, he's got some motor problems and stuff. But the point being that we have dramatic, what's called graceful degradation, where if you damage the system, it doesn't just all of a sudden show catastrophic failure. It gets gradually worse, just like the human system. And the symbolic systems have a problem with this. So the second approach, the connections to neural network approach, the central question here is how do nervous systems extract information from the environment? How do they encode it? How do they use it to make decisions and behavior? And how do they process it? And if you think about this model naturally has both an information processing phase where inputs from the senses and from memory come in and flow through the system and then make either a judgment or decision or behavior or something. And let's say that a kid sees a red fire or something and reaches out because it's pretty and gets burned, then there's this sort of back feedback of information into the system, and so the child will adjust his cognitive state so in the future he won't reach for burning things. The basic element, so this model, this connectionist or neural network model, derives from, is based on neurobiology and neuroscience data. And so the basic element in neuroscience or in the brain is the neuron. And there are many different kinds of neurons in the brain, but neuroscientists have made the observation, or at least computer scientists who are building on that work, have made the observation that many of these neurons perform, they have sort of a macroscopic, at the macroscopic level, they have a similar structure. So they've got these dendrites on the input where they kind of collect activation from all the other neurons and the sensory inputs that they're connected to. They've got a cell body in the middle which does some kind of transformation, maybe adds them all up and makes a decision about how much activation it should send down to other neurons connected to it. And then there's the axon, which is how it then sends its activation down the line. These are like wires connecting those things to one another. And so many different kinds of neurons show this same basic structural plan in behavior. And so we, in the connectionist framework, we create a simple little node which is meant to stand in for those enhancing those same properties. And so the basic job of the node is to collect information from all of the inputs connected to it and to add them together, to sum them up. And then it's supposed to, proportional to how much activation is on the input, it's supposed to send a certain amount of activation down the line. It's proportional, but in a nonlinear way. So let's try and get a concrete example of this, even though the details aren't right because it's not symbolic. But there's a debate in the literature over whether things called grandmother cells exist, which is cells that are dedicated to recognizing one class of stimuli. And so the question is there a cell that fires when I see my grandmother and doesn't fire to other stimuli? So let's pretend that there is such a cell. And the way it would work is all these dendrites are going out to other systems, and let's say that there's activation coming in on this line, and that somehow represents that there's gray hair, there's a certain kind of glasses, she's holding cookies, she smells like cinnamon. And if there's enough activation on this cell, which is dedicated to my grandmother, then I will fire down the line, which indicates that my grandmother is present. Now, this is not the right way to think about what connections networks do, but it's not easy to talk about it at the right level, which is sub-symbolic. So sort of the right way to think about it is we don't know what those features would be that this neuron would be recognizing. It could be, you know, a particular lock of hair in conjunction with a certain kind of shoe. It could be, you know, distance between the eyes. The point is that these systems self-organize in ways that we can't easily translate into symbolic structures. I mean, that's a fundamental difference between these two theoretical frameworks, the symbolic and the connections. And so that should give you some intuition about how these things work. So talking about the network, the human brain is organized in layers of processing. So when visual input comes in to my retina, it travels up the optic nerve, goes to something called the lateral geniculate nucleus, it goes through the optic radiation, which is a set of fibers to the back of the head. And so we can create kind of a block diagram of these different steps in the processing system, and we then create a connections network based on that. And so we try to be informed by the architecture of the real brain when we can, and make intelligent guesses when we can't, about how we should structure our models. So in the network, sometimes, or generally, nodes are arranged in layers. At least in the connections framework, nodes are arranged in layers because that's how the brain seems to be arranged to a large extent. Or at least that seems to be an important property of the brain's arrangement. And the links between nodes, right, these have what are called weights, and they're modifiable, and that's where learning does its thing. So in the case of my grandmother, maybe holding cookies is not, to go back to the symbolic example, maybe holding cookies is not as great an indicator as, you know, gray hair and certain kind of glasses. So the weights on these features, gray hair and certain kind of glasses, would be greater than she has cookies, and so you can see how I'd be more likely to identify her by the features that are stable to my grandmother than to these other kinds of features, which may contribute, but not dominate the determination about whether my grandmother is here or not. So the third piece, we've talked about the node and the network architecture, is the learning mechanism. And in a connections network, information, right, in the symbol approach, let's do a contrast, the information is stored in symbol structures, propositions about the world, Aristotle the man, and rules on those structures, symbolic rules manipulating those structures. In the connections network, the information is encoded in the pattern of weights between neurons, between nodes. So in the grandmother example, for instance, right? Learning, and one of the assumptions of this framework is that the learning changes these weights. So when the kid touches the hot pan or the hot fire, what happens in the feedback is that the weights between things change in my head to sort of discourage me in the future from doing that. And an interesting feature of this, just to show that we're starting to match some of the qualitative properties of human cognition and behavior, is that you can teach these networks by example. You can give them, you know, 100 different examples of handwritten A's from 100 different people. You can tell them on the output this is an A. And it will learn what an A is, and it will also generalize to new exemplars. So it's got kind of this nice property. Another sort of misattribution of this framework is that people say, oh, this is not a plausible kind of learning mechanism because when I see an A, nobody's always standing there to tell me this is an A, this is a B, you know, this is not an A, whatever. There's not this kind of one-to-one correspondence of seeing a stimulus and then having some kind of teacher feedback that the correct information. However, that's a misunderstanding of what is going on here. There are a whole bunch of different kinds of learning algorithms that are used in these models. Some don't depend on the output at all. They simply go with correlations on the input, such as you might see in classical conditioning, where we associate the meat and the bell. There are other kinds which can use, I predict, I'm always thinking, expecting things about the world, and if what I expect from as a result of my behavior doesn't happen, I can use that discrepancy as information to go and change my weights in the future as well, or at least to update my model, my expectations. So the connections approach was pioneered by, it's got an interesting history. Back in the 50s and 60s, when people started doing these symbolic things, another group of people also started looking at different kinds of models than the symbolic models, which were an early form of neural network called perceptrons. And they saw that they had some of the right properties, but weren't sure exactly whether we could get all of cognition out of this early model. So in 1969, Seymour Papert and Martin Minsky wrote this book, Perceptrons, in which they proved mathematically that the perceptron that they were using could not possibly be the basis for human cognition. So a very powerful demonstration of kind of what you can do when you are this concrete about your theories, right, about cognition and development. And some more contemporary figures on the scene, although McClellan and Romelhart are still active, doing great work, Ellman and McWhinney, these guys have added sort of the developmental component. They've looked at it from a developmental perspective more than the original pioneers. So we've seen, I've gone and given an overview of the elements right in the connectionist framework. The thing to take away are that the representation or the information in the system is in the weighted connections between nodes, and there's some constraints at least on what the network can learn or will learn based on the architecture of those nodes, or the architecture of the network, how those nodes are connected to one another, right, how many layers, whether they're connected in feedback loops or just forward, etc. And so at any given time, the knowledge that the system is sort of accessing is determined by the pattern of activation across the network. It's not located in any one place like it was in the symbol structures. The computation or processes that are going on are really around the nodes, right? The node transforms its inputs into some output, and the evolution of the pattern of activation across the network. Again, very different from the symbol approach where you can point and say that's the knowledge, there's where it's reasoning. This is kind of it's a much more difficult system to analyze because the knowledge is distributed. And finally, there are kind of two ways that people think about these in a developmental from a developmental perspective. The first is, if we take snapshots of the system as it learns, right, at different points in time, people have tried to point and say this is where the qualitative organization of the knowledge is, you know, the first stage, the second stage, the third stage at different points. So it's a product of the learning plus the nonlinear properties of this system. And the second approach is, we know that kids, right, or people, I guess, but kids in particular have a lot of structural changes going on during development. For instance, you start out with three times as many neurons as you're going to end up with in adolescence. And so some people have tried to add this to their models where it prunes out nodes that are not used, or myelinization occurs to sort of wrap the neuron axons in sort of fatty material to make them more conductive. And people have also tried to simulate that kind of an effect, you know, a massive systemic architectural change in their connectionist models to capture some of these different shifts that occur in development. So let's take the same example of learning to read aloud, which we looked at with the symbolic approach, symbolic model. So the only assumption we make here in this model, well, the only assumption about sort of the processing system, is that the weights on connections, sorry, the information about how to go from words that you read to speaking them, reading aloud, is in the weights of the network, right? So notice that this is very different from the two root model we saw with the symbolic model. There's no place for an independent store of exceptions, and there's no separation of rules from knowledge, right? All the rules, all the knowledge, you know, rules, whatever you want to call them, are stored in the weights between connecting nodes. So that's a very different kind of perspective on this model. The original model, which was made by Seidenberg and McClelland in 1989, had three levels of processing. You'd feed in it had these orthographic units, one representing a combination of like first letter in the word plus what the letter is, so position plus letter. And they had 400 of these orthographic units, and they fed in all of these monosyllabic words in English. This system has no representation of time, so they couldn't do multiple syllables. And then they had this second layer, which had 200 units in it. Each one of these ovals is just sort of represent a large number of nodes or neurons. And then on the output, they had the phonological representation, right, which would be the phonemes that correspond to the spellings on the input. The results of this model simulation were that it did a good job. The model did a good job predicting certain qualitative, quantitative, I guess qualitative effects of human latency. So, for instance, if I'm looking at a word like repertoire, which in English is not a very regular mapping from what I see, there's an O-I-R-E at the end, but I don't really hear it, from that to the speaking of it, there would be a longer latency compared to something like car, although repertoire has got multiple syllables, but ignore that for the moment, like car, which is very concrete, and I can hear the C, the A, and the R. And so humans show a longer latency when they're trying to speak words that have an irregular mapping, and so does this network. And another effect was that the number of words with similar spellings affects how long it takes you to say the word, and this predicted that in the right direction qualitatively. So the other important sort of feature of this network behavior was that it learned both regular and irregular words. Regular and exception words without, you can see, you know, there was just one mechanism, one generic architecture for all these words. So we don't have to posit kind of the two roots that we saw in the symbolic model. According to Occam's razor, we're always looking for the most parsimonious theory that will explain a set of data. And so this is kind of it's an interesting counterpoint to the original model. This particular incarnation of the connections model is poor at generalizing to non-words, so it didn't do a good job, this one to made, and it's poor at deciding whether a word is a real word or not. It wouldn't recognize that, whereas the symbolic model didn't have problems with those. Other people did additional kind of improvements and refinements to this model to see if they could overcome some of these limitations, and in fact, they did overcome a lot of them. So you can see once you get kind of the basic idea down, people are always trying to play with these models to figure out what it will take to handle the exceptional cases, you know, to handle more of the data, things like that. So just to summarize, to contrast the symbolic with the connections approach, it's interesting to note that the strengths of one are, generally speaking, the weaknesses of the other, and vice versa. So whereas the symbolic models are not, they don't have the right qualitative properties of human thought, the neural network models do. They have this graceful degradation. You can start cutting connections between nodes, and because these are not symbolic relationships, right, they're distributed, any one node is not super critical to the overall behavior of the network, so you can start cutting them, and they'll only gradually degrade. They've got content addressable memory, which means in a symbolic kind of database approach, if I wanted to look at, if I knew a guy, his first name was M, and he was my TF, and I couldn't think of his name, in a symbolic approach, I'd have to search through all the facts in my database and match all of the little tidbits that I knew about it, find all the things that start with M, find out if there's a property of that thing that says he's my TF, before I could decide. And it's a very lengthy process, which is not like humans do it. I mean, you know that it's Mike right away, presumably. However, the neural networks do this really well. You can give them a part of the information, the full information that you're looking for, and they'll produce that. Similarly, it's got a good count of learning. It's built into the model. It's essential to it. And it does a really good job with implicit sensory motor and active kinds of knowledge, which, if you remember the symbolic approach, didn't do a good job in. It's two other items. One is that it's based on neuroscientific data, which is a nice grounding for the framework, as opposed to one that's kind of ad hoc and reflective, and it's very good at generalization. So, like I said, if I give it 10 A's, it'll learn to categorize new ones. The weakness is, though, it's not very good at explicit symbolic kinds of knowledge, unlike the symbolic approach. There's kind of this trade-off. With a simple approach, we can add new facts in one shot. We just put them in there. These models tend to learn gradually, and if you learn too quickly, they learn poorly. They disrupt the learning that's already gone on. So these are some properties that are not that it's not very strong at. And also, it's not very good at deductive reasoning. The way that the networks are built right now, it's much better at kind of inference and inductive reasoning. However, one can see that as we learn more neuroscience, we can improve these models and extend them in natural ways that sort of conform to this body of data, whereas it's hard to see how we're going to take the symbolic ones and instantiate them. That's kind of the same problem that we both face is trying to bridge across to the other level of analysis. Just a couple of points about information processing approaches in general. Typically, when we're looking at cognitive development, right, we collect a lot of behavioral data. We might know some things about, we might have some theories about how kids operate and what they're going through during development, but we're kind of bound to the data as far as refuting a theory or providing evidence for it. I'm going to review two dramatic examples of information processing theories, one from symbolic and one from connectionist, that are just mentioned, not review them, but mention how these, making your theory concrete and computational, and they're complex enough that you need to run them on computers, although that's not central to theory itself, it gives you a kind of leverage, or you can reason about these things sort of logically and philosophically and make some important kinds of deductions or conclusions about them. So the first example, Chomsky wrote a review in the New York Review of Books on verbal behavior, Skinner's book on trying to elaborate how behaviors we could explain higher cognitive processes of humans, such as language. And what Chomsky did basically was say, look, given your, if I were to take your behaviorist framework and translate it into information processing terms, he didn't do that explicitly, but this is the sort of gist of what he did. Here are the reasons why it's fatally flawed from the standpoint of explaining language. You know, things like people make Freudian slips and they do spoonerisms where they exchange one word in the sentence for another. That sort of shows that they need to have the whole thing worked out in their head before they utter it, whereas in behaviorism, it's all these contingencies, one word to the next, and it's flawed from that perspective. So that, and people attribute sort of the death, you know, one of the death blows to behaviorism, the whole superstructure that this review sort of contributed to that. And a second dramatic example is, as I said before, people suggested that this early form of neural network perceptron could be the basis for all human cognition, and that they, you know, it's just a matter of sort of solving in each domain now. Minsky and Papert in 1969 wrote this book showing they proved mathematically and logically that this could not be the basis for human cognition. And when you have a model that can be falsified in that way, and that definitively, that's a very powerful, it's what scientists look for. They don't want theories that you can't prove them. They want theories that can be falsified in theory, but are not falsified by the evidence. So this is a very powerful aspect of this whole approach. Just to review, first I talked about two central concepts, representation and computation. Representation is simply, it's sort of synonymous with knowledge, with an emphasis on the format in which that knowledge is stored. Computation is a transformation from one kind of representation to another. And then I talked about two major frameworks, the symbol approach and the connectionist approach, and try to show how these two things are right now kind of operating at two different levels. They've got strengths, they've got weaknesses, and we can't really throw either one out at this point. But the ultimate goal, really, is to try and understand how we can bridge from one to the other and make both theories completely consistent. And neither one will be gone very soon because we have a long, long way to go before that gap is crossed.
Didn't work at the beginning, but it did, yeah.
Ooh, I think I was talking too fast.
It was, what was it?